be a requirement of farmers who were recruiting directly workers for their own operation. That is not the intent of the proponents. This is a labor contractor bill and not a bill directed at farmers who are doing their own recruiting. I'd like to talk briefly about Section 7 of the bill. At the low end of the labor, and there are some very decent, honorable folks involved in farm labor contracting who are trying to do things correctly, but at the low end of the scale, we're dealing with folks who are involved probably in alien smuggling, probably in drug smuggling as well. You're essentially not talking about very nice people. And under those circumstances, they have really very little to lose from the civil sanctions. They're shifting about. It's difficult to find their property. They don't have any situs of operation. So a judgment against them is not terribly useful. And the criminal sanctions that exist in the law, as compared to the sanctions that already exist for the kinds of activities they're engaged in, are practically petty. With that in mind, essentially what we would ask the committee to do is strengthen the criminal sanctions behind this bill and say that the first time you engage unlawfully in contracting without a license, the penalties stay the same. But if you know or should know that you've got a duty and you're just acting in defiance of that duty because either you've been convicted previously of the misdemeanor offense of acting without a license, or because your license has been denied, suspended, or revoked, or because you're acting in violation of outstanding injunction of a court in acting as a farm labor contractor, then in those circumstances, the criminal penalty ought not to be a misdemeanor anymore, but it ought to be escalated to a Class C felony.
What are the penalties, again, if I may interrupt, for a Class C felony? What do we got there? How much jail, how much jail time? We'll create another penalty for which somebody's going to come and ask for indigent defense to pay for?
I believe it's 5 years.
5 years or $50,000.
All right.
Unless changed by the new sentencing guidelines, which provide emphasis on probation for Class C felony.
Frankly, this would probably be subject to probation.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'd next like to focus on Section 10 of the Act. Almost by definition, labor contracting is an interstate activity. You have migrant workers that are recruited here to go out of state, recruited elsewhere to come to the state to work. Because of that, it is almost always the case that there's a piece of the picture that occurs outside of Oregon. And in attempting to enforce the Act, we're almost always met with a defense that Oregon law doesn't apply because this contract was consummated in Texas or because the work's to be done in Idaho. And we've actually had a circuit court in Marion County rule, grant a motion to dismiss the whole case because an Oregon contractor recruiting workers in Oregon who are Oregon residents to do work in Idaho, because the work was to be done in Idaho, they threw the whole case out. Now, that case is one that we will appeal, but our intent in Section 10 is to make clear that Oregon intends its law to reach as far as Oregon has constitutional power to regulate. On Section 11, we believe that the Bureau of Labor has rulemaking power under the Act as it is. However, in looking at the latest round of rulemaking that the Bureau did, the statute grants specific rulemaking powers as to this provision or that provision, but nowhere grants a general rulemaking power. Just to be sure that the Bureau's rules are pursuant to adequate authority, we think they are anyway, probably, but we just wanted to be sure of that, and we add a general rulemaking power to enforce the provisions of the statute. Now, as drafted by Legislative Council, I believe it just only says to, as to the provisions of this Act, we really intended that to mean of the entire farm labor contractor registration scheme, including existing law. Finally, Section 12 deals with service by alternative means on unlicensed contractors. These folks are not easy people for the sheriff to find or for a processor server to find. They're on the move, they're going here, they're there, they're on the job for a while, then they go somewhere else. They may not have a domicile in the state of Oregon, so it's difficult to find them. For registered farm labor contractors, in that circumstance, you can serve the Bureau of Labor, and that's adequate service. We feel that unlicensed contractors who are doing business here should not be in a better position with respect to service process than licensed contractors, and propose language drawn from the motor vehicle statutes to essentially allow similar kind of service on unlicensed contractors who are doing business in the state unlawfully. Essentially, what would be required is you'd serve the Bureau of Labor, you'd serve the last known address, if any, of the contractor, and any other address that reasonably, with a reasonable degree of inquiry, you should know would give adequate notice. Usually we have a farmer or someone who's dealt with the contractor that can actually get notice to them, and we would serve those folks. That concludes my remarks on Senate Bill 731.
32, 33.
Okay. On 732, what I would say is this. I don't have really prepared remarks, but I would say this. There needs to be better enforcement. The genesis of this bill really came from a study that was done by the State Housing Council last summer. They came up with the recommendation that there ought to be one agency doing farm labor camp enforcement. That immediately set off a lot of scurrying and anxiety and concern about what effect this would have on legal authority of one agency or another, whether it would cause problems with the federal agencies that they deal with, and a variety of other kinds of problems. Our perspective is that it's not that we have too many agencies or too many people out there enforcing farm labor camp standards, rather to the contrary, that there's too little enforcement, and that whatever resources that there are to bring to bear on this problem ought to be coordinated in an effective way. This is one attempt to try to do that, leaving most of the basic responsibilities of the two agencies where they are. I independently have investigated the question about whether you could create full authority in one agency or the other without getting real problems. I don't think you can do it, and in that you can't do it, there needs to be some coordination. I'm not sure that what we've come up with is the final solution or the best solution. In fact, in recent discussions with folks at the Department of Insurance and Finance, it's been suggested that all of registration could move to the Bureau of Labor so long as there was assurance that Insurance and Finance had an adequate list of registered camps so they could do their inspections. I think that something might be able to be worked out along those lines. I know that there are representatives of both agencies here today. We don't really have any vested interest in how this is done. We do feel strongly that this ought not, that resolution of this issue ought not to stand in the way of moving forward on some of the other things, and that there ought to be a reasonable way to coordinate the activities of the two agencies. Moving to Senate Bill 731, this is the most important piece of legislation in our view.
731?
I'm sorry, 733. In our view, this is the most important piece of legislation that is before you or before the legislature.
Oh, can I interrupt? I just had an errant thought come back. I understand why we want, I understand that we want to give situs of the service at the Bureau of Labor. What's the purpose? What's the point? What does that mean? Okay, if you can't find this person, you don't know where they are, so you deliver the subpoena to the to Bowling.
Wouldn't be a subpoena. It would be.
Or whatever the service of process. Okay, what happens?
What happens?
Why do we do that, and what does that mean to me?
Okay, the reason we need to do that is that if we're going to get a judgment against this contractor, the contractor won't disappear and go away forever and ever. We just need to get him served, and get him served within the statute of limitations. If the court finds that there's adequate notice, which is the best notice that could be given under the circumstances, constitutionally, that's adequate notice to bring you within the statute of limitations, then you can proceed with your lawsuit.
Proceed with the suit and to a judgment.
That's right.
Okay.
That's correct.
So the assumption is that the contractor knows or ought to know that if there is service process against him or her, then the place that they should look for that while they've been absent from the state or did not have a domicile would be at the Bureau.
That's correct.
During any normal business day, they'd be able to find that out.
That's correct.
Good.
Moving to 733, we regard this as the most significant piece of legislation that's before the Legislative Assembly this session regarding farm workers. In our experience over the last 10 years, we've seen lots of things happen to farm workers. The most serious abuses all have occurred in circumstances where the farm workers were living in housing sites that were isolated and under the control of the employer, often a labor contractor, sometimes even the farmer himself. And over the years, I've come to the conclusion that this is no accident that it occurs this way. I'll have to beg the pardon of people who've heard me say this before, but I think it's the proper analogy. I think that mold grows in the dark. Where there's no light, where there's no traffic with the mainstream community, and you have folks that are dependent for their very livelihood, and I don't mean livelihood in the sense of wages, I mean livelihood in the sense of the beans that they eat at night, where they're dependent upon the employer for those things, it creates a situation that is just an invitation to exploitation. And lots of farmers do a great job, and I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but when you create that kind of isolation, you create the kind of circumstance that gives you exploitation and abuse. Workers don't have any independent means of transportation in many, many circumstances. They'll be isolated far from the nearest city. There's no telephone. They're are labor camps that nobody goes in and out of. Not only does no one go in, but workers are not free themselves to leave at their will either, except just to go and work and to return. Frequently what happens is you have people that are recruited up here, they're recruited here too early, they owe the coyote for their passage here. They create more debt during the time they're waiting for work to start because they're being charged for food and sometimes lodging. They have a debt, and basically they're kept till the debt's paid. Debt's paid by working it off through their labor and deduction from their wages, and they're not free to go until that happens. That can only occur in a camp where access is restricted, and it is this situation of peonage that permits the kinds of abuses to occur that occur. And all the laws we pass about labor camps and, you know, incentives and better wages and raise the minimum wage for farm workers, none of it means a hill of beans if you don't open these camps up that are essentially prison camps. Now, there is a statute to try to do this. In 1981, I know some of the members of the committee were involved with the deliberations on that statute. There was an effort made to try to open the camps up a bit. But our experience with that statute has proven it to be inadequate to the task of really creating the kind of communication that is necessary. I'd like to give you a few examples just to kind of give you the sense of what kinds of problems we're experiencing. We had some farm workers that were having problems with subminimum wages and bad living conditions. By subminimum wages, we're talking about making $8 over three 12-hour days. That's the kind of subminimum wages we're talking about. Some of them happened to be out on a road and encountered one of our workers who invited the worker to come and talk to them at the camp. The attorney attempted to make arrangements to do that, called ahead of time to make sure there was no misunderstanding about who he was and why he was there, and that he had an invitation to be there. The result was that some of the workers, he didn't disclose who had invited him, but I guess the farmer figured it out some way, and some of the workers were discharged. And they were discharged at about midnight and taken down to Hillsboro with about $20 in their pocket. These happened to be folks from Guatemala who had never been in the United States before, knew no one here other than this casual conversation they had with an attorney on the road, didn't know where they were or where they were going or where they would find any sustenance next. We still had clients out at the camp and wanted to visit. Those clients were concerned about what was happening at the camp because we'd received words from those workers about a severe beating received by one worker who tried to leave the camp. And so we wanted to go on out there. We tried to exercise our right to visitation. We're asked by the camp operator, who happened to be a farmer, to leave. We did so. We went into court, sought injunctive relief under the statute. At that point, the farmer said, well, if you tell us who invited you, we'll let you come on. Under the circumstances we found ourselves, there was no way in good conscience we could, not knowing whether we'd really actually even get access to these individuals, there was no way that we could release the names of the people that had invited us. That case went to trial in Washington County. The judge there, after a three-day trial, found that the farmer had acted in retaliation against the workers, had frustrated the rights of access, and ordered injunctive relief. It was appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals reversed on the basis of interpretation of this question about whether invited people have to disclose who invited them. That case is on review. That's one of the things that we're trying to get at through this statute.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hill.
Michael, for the record, what's the citation on that case?
I don't have the citation at the on the tip of my tongue. The case is Martinez versus Tankersley. And the Supreme Court is granted a petition for review, and it has not yet been argued in the Supreme Court. Trying to gain access to clients in the camp in different ways, our workers tried to meet workers at a Grange Hall near the camp and on the public road. A guard of the camp operator raced a pickup truck at our workers interviewing a farm worker, narrowly missing them, took out a shotgun that had been provided by the camp owner and waved it at him. Another meeting up the Grange Hall with some workers, the farmer himself came to and disrupted basically by intimidating the farm workers. And some of the workers that were at that second meeting were then taken by van by the farmer with a gun in the car to the Portland International Airport to be put on a plane to Mexico, in spite of the fact that the workers did not want to go to Mexico. It would be, were it not so outrageous, it would be almost comical the way these workers escaped was essentially they grabbed an airport policeman and held on to him. He could not understand them, they could not understand him, but it became apparent to the officer that they didn't want to go. The farmer left and left him there at the airport. This is the kind of situation that we're encountering trying to work under this existing statute. Now, meanwhile, the denial of basic information needed by farm workers to protect themselves continues unabated. This past summer, there were farm workers living in a chicken coop at a labor camp, so isolated that there was virtually no contact with the outside world. Ironically, the labor contractor involved in running that camp kept fighting cocks who were living in better conditions than the farm workers were living in that chicken coop. When workers tried to escape from that camp, they were kidnapped, beaten, and returned to forced labor. One of them escaped during the night, walked into Hillsborough, and was able to gain the assistance of the Washington County Sheriff, who a deputy found the other worker suffering from a concussion, disoriented in Strawberry Field the next day. And when I say kidnapped, beaten, and returned, this particular labor contractor was in fact convicted of kidnapped in this particular incident. I wouldn't want the committee to think, though, because there was justice done in this particular case, that there aren't other cases that go unremedied, because there are other cases.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gransky.
Maybe I'm confused, but what does the commission of a crime on anybody got to do with this legislation?
Well, what it has to do with is that these labor camps are so isolated with so little contact from the outside world that basically it allows farm labor contractors and employers who want to do so to so intimidate and so dominate the lives of the workers who live there that literally they're kept in a state of slavery, Senator.
So you're referring to the provision about having a paid telephone?
The provision of having a paid telephone and the provision of having access to and from the camp and basically guaranteeing farm workers the right to have in their homes the same kind of freedom of association that other workers in the state enjoy. Another incident that I was going to describe, a brother, a farm worker being held at a camp, wrote a brother saying that he needed some help getting out. Family went to the camp to get him out, was not allowed to see the worker until his debt was paid. And actually, the sister-in-law went with her bank card to withdraw funds and was unable to withdraw a sufficient amount of funds to get the debt paid. The worker was only released when he came down with chickenpox, and they didn't want him there anymore. And so they called and said that they'd come get the worker. Our legislation basically does several things. It opens up the scope of folks that are allowed to be present at the camp. It reverses the Court of Appeals with respect to disclosing the source of an invitation, although it is clear that if someone abuses that invitation, the farmer or the labor contractor is free to bring civil or criminal trespass action against that person. If the person's going to try to make out a defense that they're an invited person under the statute, then in that proceeding, they're going to have to disclose, and by that point, I feel relatively confident it's likely that the worker's no longer likely to be there, and we could live with that.
Who all would be a qualifying 501c3 organization? That's all charitable, educational, philanthropic, eleemosynary, etc. All of
that's
those
correct.
Folk.
That's correct.
That's a lot of folk. Isn't it? We normally think of that being a lot of folk.
Well, it is more people than have access now, but fewer people than I can invite to my home or that can come and knock on my door.
I understand that.
I mean, essentially, the effort, Senator Cairns, is to attempt to identify classes of people who are unlikely to be there to pimp or to bring alcohol onto the premises or to recruit away someone's workers or to do the kinds of things that farmers sometimes have expressed concern about in the past.
Senator Shoemaker.
Technical question. You limit that to organizations exempt from income tax under Section 501c3. Why just C3? Why not 501c, which then include nonprofit corporations, which are not taxed, but to which you may not contribute deductible contributions? You know, I wonder if maybe this shouldn't be just a little bit broader so that you could include a whole range of nonprofit, publicly oriented corporations.
Why don't we direct staff to give us a general list of the two types of C and C3.
There's about five subdivisions, at least four under sub C, and I think probably all logically would qualify.
Yeah, let's take a look at those.
Final thing I haven't dealt with in the testimony that I think is important is that in the original legislation, the remedy provided essentially was to say that anyone who was aggrieved under this act had all the remedies available under the civil rights statute. And it did not amend the civil rights statute remedy provision itself. It just said everything under, it happens to be 659.121. which is the private right to sue for civil rights type violations. There are two subsections of that section. One deals with housing type discrimination, and it provides for compensatory and a limited amount of punitive damages. There's also an employment discrimination section, for which the remedy is limited to reinstatement and back pay. It was clearly the intent, I believe, of the 81 legislature to include both sets of remedies. That becomes clear in the fact that a visiting person is an aggrieved person for whom back pay is not much of a remedy. But in a house cleaning measure in 1983, reference was made to the Access Act in the employment discrimination section, but not in the housing discrimination section. And we would seek to restore coverage under both sections, both remedial sections.
Let's make sure we track that in our minds so we know why that amendment to 121 is made. Yeah.
Chair,
otherwise, if we were to look at it, we would look at that and say, huh?
I have another question. In section 2, sub 2A, about invited person need not disclose, I understand that was in response to a case that you mentioned. Would it be useful to include within that protection other authorized persons as well? Is there any, do you ever have a situation where the migrant is going to be harassed by the employer because an authorized person, not an invited person, comes to visit him?
The difference there is, basically, an authorized person does not need to be invited.
That's, I understand that.
On that basis, I guess I see what you're saying. We've never had, I'm not sure that there's a problem. Basically, you would not, as an authorized person, have to verify an invitation, and that's where the problem comes.
That's the authorized person comes. Doesn't need to disclose the particular employee that he is coming to see. He can
that's
just
correct.
Come on in and...
That's correct.
Okay.
Senator Hunt.
Will you identify for me the portion of the law that pertains to an authorized person may conduct himself in an illegal manner or something like that? Does your bill cover that? You gave reference to it a little while ago.
What I made reference to, I believe, Senator Howe, was that the invited person would need to disclose in a judicial proceeding as to whether they abused the right to access, would need to disclose the name of the person who invited him or her in order to make out a defense that they were an invited person. In other words, we're saying we don't want to say, well, the worker's right there and you're at the camp gate, but have no objection if you think that someone abused the right to access granted and you want to bring suit, then we could, we could disclose in the context of a judicial proceeding where things would be regulated and somewhat under control, we'd be willing to disclose the names of the other person.
Let's go back to authorized.
Okay.
Because we're opening that field up so broad.
Mm-hmm.
What protection does a owner of the camp have for that broad range of people that come under the Section 501, which I don't know what the 3 is, I don't know what the 501 is, and that could be anywhere from people operating a lottery or a bingo game a nonprofit that files under 501(c) to do that. What protection is for the owner of the camp to restrict some kind of operation that's undesirable on that property?
Essentially, the authority that exists, and it doesn't come from this bill or from the existing law, the authority that exists is that if the activity is unlawful, it's a crime.
I didn't say unlawful.
What sort of activity are you concerned about, Senator?
Conducting a card game for no profit or for no gambling.
In those circumstances, I'm not quite sure why the farmer would be concerned about regulating
the traffic
that
on the property.
I think the answer
my concern here is, or what I'm, the point I'm trying to get out here, if we're going to open that camp to that much possible ingress here, we better look at some of the protections for the landowner that, I can't see anything in here unless there's some other parts and other laws that will do that.
There are two or three considerations, I think.